very much.
How can you see into my eyes like open doors, leading you down into my core, where I've become so
listening to KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's programs or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And if you'd like to send an email into the program for questions with the guest, our email address is khen.dj@gmail.com. I am Melody, and my co-host this evening is Katie O'Brien. And we kind of had a little bit change of schedule tonight. Our guest didn't come about, but I just happened to have another lady that just happened to be emailing me, and was, I've had her as a guest on before, and so she was so gracious enough to come back on the program, and that is Jenny Lake. And I, in her subject is quite apropos for what's going on right now. And so, Jennifer, are you there?
I'm here, Melody. Hi, how are you?
Great, I'm great. And,
great.
And Katie, you there?
I'm here.
Okay, great.
Hey,
so,
Katie.
Hey, Jenny.
I'll say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHIN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And Jenny, do you want to go ahead and kind of let the public know a little bit about you and your background and then some of the subjects that we can cover here, and I'll bring them up on my computer screen here, and so I can kind of follow along with those while you're talking about them.
Okay, great. I'm happy to. A few years ago, I was a nursing student, and I had an experience in school where I was asked to look into a disease and what caused the disease, and I was able to choose my own project, and I chose polio to look at, and I learned from polio that this entire disease spectrum that is polio and polio-like is caused by chemicals and radiation. And I was digging into evidence. I learned that in the 50s there was Senate testimony about polio being caused by pesticides, and that was empirically proven at the time by very eminent doctors. And, of course, that was the age of nuclear testing. And so the experience of polio was something that was going to be on the increase at that time. And our medical establishment knew this very well. At the time, they also, since World War II, had been completely enfolded into the military. And we've been basically under a military operation ever since, as far as healthcare goes, as far as the type of medical treatment that we get. The military takes credit for having developed all the vaccines that are now routine vaccines. And, of course, there's an outcry coming from the public because of the incidence of autism and chronic illnesses being caused by vaccines. The toxic ingredients of vaccines have a confounding effect, they call it, with all these other exposures that we get from radiation, just from appliances, our computers, our TVs, our smoke detectors, and of course, we have a generation of people who were born into this nuclear age, who at a very tender time in their development got very high exposure to fallout. So this is my era of research, and lately I've been tracking the flu, the swine flu pandemic, or the bird flu, whatever you want to call it. This has been something that they've been telling us is happening now for many years.
Now, Jenny, is there is a difference between the two, isn't there, or is there not?
Well, swine flu is a common kind of flu. It's been around for a long time. What they're saying is that the H5N1, the specific genes of H5N1 bird flu, are something that at least in the Western hemisphere, we haven't been exposed to in the past. So that, you know, what's being predicted for us is that these are going to combine, that they have combined already, that this is where this outbreak started in Mexico. They're not saying it's H5N1, but they are saying that it's a novel combination of swine, avian, and human flu genes. And I've been looking into the research, just following this, what the researchers were doing with the genes of influenza, how they set up their experiments. And what I've learned, now I'm posting onto a blog. I have a new blog, and I'd love people to come visit. I'm finding out that the subjects they really care about are about this story, these flu genetics. So I posted to that the research in particular that I'm going to track, and I'm reading now, and it's about what they call the bacteriophage, which are the viruses that infect bacteria. Now, I do recall that we talked a bit last time about microbes and I had said that what I had learned from Origin of Life Science is that we're composed of 90% microbes. We're just filled with bacteria. And this is just a part of our normal composition, like everything else that's biological on the planet. So whatever happens in the microbial world is of interest to us. It's very essential to our survival and to our evolutionary adaptation that we're participating in this whole scheme of life, being microbial entities ourselves. So the bacteriophage are something that were identified on the record between 1915 and 1917. And at that time, they didn't really know what they were doing with genetics. I'm sure they had their theories, but they experimented with this material the same way they were creating filtrates from other diseases. And they would take victims' serum or take their parts. In the case of polio, they used spinal cords of children that had died of polio, and they make a mash out of that, and then they create a filtrate. And they would take this in the laboratory and inject it into laboratory animals and try and recreate the same symptoms, the same disease in the animal. And they worked at it for years and years until they had the same equivalent type of disease profile, and that was experimental polio. I think the questions that people have about virus is, what are they, where do they come from, and how does this fit in? How is it that virus are such a problem for us if they're so ubiquitous in the environment? And that's a great question. People have been asking that question for decades. In the 30s, they were fairly certain that virus was a natural byproduct of the system, and that we produce virus in our bodies, and that this helps us deal with damage to certain kinds of our tissue. So we produce different viruses for different kinds of tissues.
So are you saying then virus is a reaction to an invasion or an infection?
It's a response.
Or toxin? Okay, right.
That's
right.
What I'm saying. Okay. Right. It's an attempt of the body to maintain homeostasis. And this is exactly what bacteriophage do in the bacterial world. And I can find identical kinds of thoughts with the bacteria. So applying it to ourselves, then, it's not as easy to hunt down these kind of statements about human health. But there are some very good scientists out there who are making those kinds of statements. And someone who has certainly opened my eyes to that is a doctor in Germany named Stefan Lanka. He spells his last name L-A-N-K-A. And he was looking into evolutionary processes. And that, combined with other origin of life science that I looked at, was very convincing to me that virus are very necessary components. It's a natural way for matter to organize itself to bring life forth. And they know from the bacteriophage studies that they did during the 20s and 30s in particular that there was some kind of transfer going on, that phage was changing its genes and swapping its genes. So when I started taking this whole experimental picture into view and how much they were just experimenting without restraint on all kinds of biological life, they were using x-rays to mutate things. They were seeing how much dosage they could give to bacteria. This was certainly part of this whole experimental picture, in addition to what they were refining as they went along in terms of genetics.
So with what you're saying here, does that kind of, what do I want to say the term, it, it's it's saying something different than what's being the accepted norm in medicine today with viruses. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you know, as far as, you know, the public is concerned, we still are generally under this impression that that viruses are living organisms, that they don't change, that they just, you know, spread around the environment, and they hop from species to species or person to person, and that they're potential disease agents. And we've been under this whole, you know, thought form here for more than a century. This came along in the 1870s and 1880s, and it's very good for supporting the kind of medicine that's been upheld in allopathic medicine. But we're at the losing end by now. You know, this is the problem, is that we see this escalation of disease, and we point to all kinds of things which are certainly implicated in a part of it, which is pollution and atmospheric change and who knows what. All of these things combine and increase in our level of sickness as a population. But breaking it down, you know, item by item, and just going after cause and looking at studies, medical treatment is so responsible for so much of the chronic illness that's around. So it's just time. It's time for us to look at this deeply and question this whole method and make decisions about whether or not this is the kind of treatment we want. If public health can support the kinds of, I guess you could say, trade-offs that we'd have to endure.
Well, you know, it's just kind of another step for those people that have been in the world of what you call alternative medicine, to just take it just one step further and realize that there's more to the lie than just, you know, the fact that the medical community has been led to believe. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes sense to me. You know, were you thinking about all the different kinds of treatment and all the different science opinions that are out there?
What I'm saying is, okay, if just alone on what you're talking about with the viruses and the reaction of the body and what are the mechanisms and the organisms that are involved, as opposed to, you know, what those that have become frustrated with the treatments that they've been given by the allopathic community. And so now we're finding that that's under attack. And and if we don't start doing something, opening our eyes more to the fact that there's more of a story behind it than that.
Yeah, there's a lot to the story. And that's why I think, you know, as long as I want to keep doing it, I won't run out of material. You know, I've been looking into history and looking at radiation and nuclear tests and writing about that. Something that I added to my webpage was a series that I'm still working on, and it's called Fathers of the Bomb, and looking at how we ended up getting nuclear weapons in the world, and why is it that, you know, the United States has detonated more nuclear tests than any other nation. We've blown off more than 2,000 bombs. You know, the Russians have set off 1,000 or so. Another 400 or 500 with other countries doing their tests, and that we've never had a good accounting of this for so many reasons. And, you know, the potential here, just from the chemistry, from the kinds of damage that radiation can do, you know, how this is affecting demographics and how this affects the baby boomers in particular. And, you know, so many decisions that they get made based on this reflection of illness in the public, you know, it's still withheld. It's still a mystery.
Well, it's kind of like when you're, when even to grasp and look at some of the information that you're starting to come out with, and talk about, which again, even some of them that I'm hearing a lot of related information about, I'm not too sure too many of them have put the correlation to the bomb testing as not so much a war, not the type of war that we believe it to be, but more of a war on the human population than it is on specific populations, if I'm stating that correctly. And that's thinking outside of the box in a way that I see that it's hard, would be hard for a lot of people to do initially.
Mm-hmm.
Until you start going back as far as you have in the history and then start piecing things together.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, things like chemtrails are sort of re-alerting us to what fallout is, you know. And a lot of things that I think were learned in the 50s about fallout really apply now, as far as, you know, spreading particulate matter into the atmosphere and where it's going to go, how things are concentrating, you know, and they end up circulating and concentrating at the poles. And we have a lot to learn from fallout. And I hope that the resources that I need to help demonstrate what I'm talking about don't disappear on me before I get a chance. I had some very good fallout maps that were attached to one of the articles that I wrote. Those maps are gone. I can't find them anymore on the Internet. And they have very specific graphs of cloud trails and where this fallout went and over what period of time, so that, you know, people who had questions about their exposure would be able to at least access, you know, this particular set of maps or that particular set. And these things are seemingly not as accessible as they were.
Are you familiar with Lorraine Murray?
I've heard of Lorraine Murray, and I've listened to her speak one time.
Okay, well, if anybody would have a maps of those, she may be the the person to talk to, but because I do know that I've had her on a couple of times on the program, and she had talked about these, you know, tracking, you know, where these fallout from DU in the atmosphere and, you know, the radiation.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much during this period of time also that it just has been absorbed by trees and other plants that, you know, events like big wildfires and things cause what they call repollution, and you just re-release it back into the atmosphere, and there it goes again. So the very long-lasting isotopes that, you know, maintain this very toxic level of radioactivity are going to be around for tens of thousands of years. And, you know, whoever is left on the planet way into our future, we'll still be dealing with the radioactivity that we created here.
Did any of the maps that you have indicate the radioactivity that was produced by the experimental blast out in Nevada?
Are you talking about a new blast?
No, the ones that happened back in the 40s.
Oh, okay.
In the 40s.
Right. Well, they actually started the Nevada test site. I think its first tests were done in January of 1951. And before that, they had been done in the Pacific. After World War II, they were done out in the Marshall Islands, the Bikini Atoll. Mm-hmm. Most people have heard of that. They started their testing there. The first test was called Operation Crossroads, and that was in 1946. And they set off two bombs there, and these were huge biological experiments. They lined up all these ships that they were either retiring from war service or that they had captured in World War II, and they put animals on board, lots of pigs and goats and chickens. They had biological material. They had food supplies, medical supplies. Anything that was relevant to human use was also added into this mix with all these animals. And they had animals on the islands as well. And when they, after they detonated the bombs, they sent sailors in there. They were supposed to give them a couple of hours to wait until the clouds dissipated somewhat. But I read accounts of this where they were in there on the ships and on the islands within an hour. So they were getting very high exposures at that time. They gave those men cotton gloves for protection. And they had them collect all the dead animals and save those specimens so they could be taken back to labs. Now, some of those animals at the time also had been given vaccines. They had been given what were thought to be protective vaccines of some kind. They were obsessed with what they called the nuclear battlefield. So all the tests, once they started in Nevada, they were actually putting personnel on the ground. And I think we did talk about this the last time. I said that.
It seems like.
Right. That what I believed about the gamma globulin trials that they did in Provo, Utah in 1951 was actually a radiation experiment, that they believed that gamma globulin serum from polio victims had the antibodies to polio virus, and that if they gave this to the personnel, that this possibly would protect them in the event of fallout. So I feel pretty certain about that, at least as far as the timing goes. I'm very certain about polio being caused by radiation because there is plenty of documentation to back that up. And I included that in articles that I have on my webpage. And I would love to give the name of the blog. So if you
go ahead. No, keep, go ahead. No.
Okay. I'm a www.jenniferlake.wordpress.com, and my name is spelled jenniferlake.wordpress.com, and I have links there to the articles, to audios, and also just updating information as I go along, including stuff that's going on here with this new pandemic that we're having. So I believe this is being generated by the news also. And what I've seen since it started was that there is nothing that isn't normal. In fact, it's a little bit subnormal. I've been watching the CDC site give their updates. I've been going to the WHO site and getting a count of what they're doing. And they give weekly updates there. Although I haven't visited them this week because I've been very busy. So I think the total is probably about 800 or so. Are you aware of that?
Oh, I mean of people that have the flu?
This is mortality from...
Oh, okay, right.
Right, from H1N1. They're not calling it swine flu. They're just calling it influenza A H1N1. Now, that's the designation that they assigned to the Spanish flu sometime probably in the 30s, I think. Human flu viruses were discovered, they say, between 1931 and 1933. And this was also this peak time of studying bacteriophage. In fact, it really took off in the mid-1930s. And in 1937, named Max Delbruck, he came here as a displaced scholar. He was brought over to get him out of Germany, and he joined forces with another displaced scholar who came from Italy, named Salvador Luria, and they teamed up to do work on bacteriophage, and they were working at the Cold Spring Harbor. Max Delbruck had a lab during World War II at Vanderbilt University, and they were working there. They also did a lot of work out of Caltech. And they were experimenting with genetic transfer. That this was the key to that research. And this persisted. It was picked up by a lot of American researchers who were either given rank, and they were part of what they called the Armed Forces Epidemiological Board under the Army. And, you know, they sort of set up a mystery. They said that in 1956, this bacteriophage flu, specifically the flu research, just dropped. They don't really account for that, so it can't have vanished. This was the peak of the Cold War, and this was also the peak time of fallout. So we had that period from the mid-50s to the mid-60s. And so I'm on the subject. I'm just tracking and reading the studies and finding out how they use this. Now, they use the bacteria to mix the genes from the different species. The H1N1 viruses, they had learned, would recombine very easily. And so they use bacteria to mix them. They don't need to have contact between species to have this happen, because they were doing it in the lab. So that answers one question for me that kind of makes ridiculous, you know, some of the some of the claims that are made about, well, how this couldn't happen in nature, or how this could happen in nature. It's rather moot, because when you can do it with bacteria and then spread those around, there you go. There's your method.
Yeah.
And they were doing.
So are you? Is there many? I mean, because I've not heard this from anybody else in in this time. It's real interesting to see how so many different paths can get, be working in the same avenues and yet be on such in a different working with it in such a different way, and it makes so much sense of what you're saying, and that it doesn't. I mean, what, you know, they don't have to do it in nature. You're right. So all they have to do is just wait for the right timing to release it, and that's it then, correct?
Sure. You know, they were doing it intentionally just to experiment with it. So they were mixing the genes in bacteria, and what kind of bacteria, I couldn't say, but infectious bacteria, because they were shooting for success here. They didn't want to have failure. So bacteria that could normally infect the respiratory tract of, say, swine or any other species would be the bacteria of choice, to insert these genes into these bacteria and then give this, what they call now, an experimental flu to these creatures and see what happens. So,
and that is something that wouldn't be necessarily found out in nature. This would actually have to be engineered.
Well, in this case, it was engineered. But here's the thing, you know, how do you contain something like that? You know, if a level 3 or level 4 biosafety lab has problems, and they occasionally have their breakouts, which they do, intentional or accidental, how do you contain that, you know, in a period in history when those kind of facilities didn't exist?
And would this be airborne?
Airborne, yes.
So essentially, then, if you had the chemtrails or whatever, you've got like toxic metals out there to be thrown into the body to make it react in a certain way, then I mean, it sounds like they want two or three things going on at once so that this process begins to work. Are you following what I'm saying?
I'm following what you're saying. If they have genocide in mind, then what they're doing is certainly putting the right things together to cause that to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
And can they control it over specific areas, or once it's airborne, is it just carried by the wind?
Yeah, it's spread into the environment. You know, it's carried by a lot of things, so...
The wind, the water, just
yes.
all of it?
Yeah, and if they're infected with bacteria, too, you know, then animals will spread it to each other, and then, you know, the commonality of contact would be the bacteria. So,
and then if they've
you know, bacteria are everywhere,
right? And so if you're under stress and you're under a lot of circumstances that wouldn't be normal, where your immune system is way down, and you don't have access to the right foods and waters and that sort, then you know that their chances of this being effective would be
right.
much higher.
And there are things that are infectious to us, no matter what kind of shape our immune system is in. You know, I mean, there are truly infectious organisms out in the world that, you know, given the right exposure to that, you know, anybody could certainly succumb to an infection. You know, but there's a hubris about experimentation that I see when I look back at this stuff, and I see that same hubris in operation. Looking at how they expected to control radioactivity, you know, what they thought, they set themselves up with an infallible system, so they said. But there are no infallible systems. All systems break down. You know, they have a rotten track record, actually. And, you know, in our time, we've already lived to see some bad accidents at nuclear power plants with Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. And when I was traveling last summer, one of the news reports that I heard in France was that they have something like 800 radioactive spills per year from their power plants. But this is normal. That's almost three every day.
And so they have us looking all these places to where these potential wars are and this thing going on, and it's all about getting this junk in the air. It doesn't matter whether it's through DU coming from weaponry, but then it can be these reactors and then reactivating the old radiation through various means. So it's just a constant, you know, recycling then. Is that
pretty much?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So, you know, my point has always been just to go after this and account for it. And we just need an accounting as far as what happens next. I don't know. Certainly that's up to us at this point to spread the news and share it and talk about it. But I certainly think we're ready. I think we're ready, you know, we're a mature public at this point as far as health issues go. And we're ready for this dialogue. And whether or not that will ever happen is anybody's guess, really. You know, we're in rather dire economic circumstances worldwide. If this is worse than we're being told, then governments have to protect themselves. And I think, you know, there's every possibility that what's happening now is setting us up for that. And we're certainly hearing that. But to be fair, in my own mind, I need to look at both sides, all sides, and just, you know, do the best I can with the information. And also how I feel, you know, about my country, about my planet, and about life, and about, you know, our rights, what it is to have a natural right to be free, to not have to, you know, submit to law for a certain kind of health treatment. And I think Americans especially treasure that idea. So we could be being inflamed right now, and I think we are. I think there's so much disinformation going. I think the Patriot Movement itself is, you know, giving a platform for some of the worst dissent that's out there. And I recently had a run-in myself, knowing that that this is true. In fact, you've had a guest on your show, a man named Dr. Ott, who at one time said that he didn't know who I was. He might have thought I was someone else, but has had ample opportunity to know who I am in the meantime. And actually, after I did my last show with you, he had an interview where he said that he had been giving me information for years. And I addressed this on my blog because I've never spoken to him or communicated with him ever in my life. And in fact, I think his message is so out there. I've heard him speak about things like shape-shifting demons, and he has inside track on information that nobody can prove or disprove. I'm a natural skeptic on that kind of stuff, and I disagree heartily about his take on the Spanish flu. Everything that I've read says that they never found a Spanish flu virus, that they didn't know what it was at the time. The symptoms of that, a very worst part of that illness, went away after the First World War. But a whole new set of problems seemed to start plaguing the population after that, which is mycoplasma infection, other kinds of illnesses, and now something very similar to the flu that we know of today. But the Spanish flu was nothing like flu. People were dissolving. They were dying of something very hemorrhagic-like.
So you're saying it's more like an Ebola-type thing.
Well, you know, in some ways, it seems to be very many diseases. And I wrote about that too, because just to sort it out, and I'm still chasing it. I mean, that's my reason for looking at bacteriophage. There is potential here for there to have bioweapons being made at that time. That is possible, just as it's possible today. You know, but you know, we've been born into the age of nuclear annihilation, and how, you know, I just wonder, I mean, aren't we equipped to deal with this emotionally? I would think so. I would think that we should be able to honestly look at everything that happened then and just get a grip. But I think people are much more afraid of disease, much more afraid of something like a plague. Historically, this seems to be true. People are just terrified of that. And yet we're not afraid of the radiation. You know, we're not too afraid of fallout. We're not as afraid of that, and yet we don't see that either. I mean, that's another thing that seems to get by and slide inside of us in some way.
But isn't that something that our government has actually done, just getting us used to that whole idea little by little to where we don't give it a lot of credence?
You mean the fallout?
Yeah, or the radiation. I mean, people
ignore it.
Right.
We have more exposure on an intimate level with radiation today than we ever did in the time of nuclear testing. we're just not producing these huge clouds, you know, these huge plumes, you know, from bombs. Now we have a constant dose of it coming from all kinds of sources, including materials that have been added into normal building material. It's just all over the place. So we are living with it. We're even potentially adapting to it to some degree, although I have no idea, really. That's just speculation that we can or do adapt to it. I don't know that we do. There are different kinds of radiation, and some of it we can detox from ourselves, but obviously a lot of it we can't. You know, there's radiation that, you know, slices right through our cells. So, don't know what to say. You know?
Well, you might, again, kind of review a little bit of you know, the you have a timeline on your blog here, you know, the timeline between 1830 and 1900. What was so significant about that timeline and why, and its importance?
Well, that time, for Americans, we were just picking up on the kind of medicine that was being practiced in Europe. And a lot of significant events, in my mind. The Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research was founded. Now, that became a primary laboratory and research arm for the U.S. military. During the Spanish flu, during World War I, they were designated as the Army Auxiliary Lab No. 1. And in a book about Spanish flu written by a man named John Barry, he says there was no number 2. So they had the job. They were doing the research, and they became the clearinghouse for all the research that was going on in the country about Spanish flu and about other things that were plaguing the Army. So they were established in 1901. I found a first designation of something that was not considered necessary was an experiment which was adding radium to public drinking water, and that happened in 1903. At this time also, we had horrendous abuse in industrial circles. You know, low wages, no safety precautions, no humane treatment for animals in major farm and stock operations. The reason why they passed the Pure Food and Drug Law in 1906 was because they had stirred up the public. In fact, it was a book, that, as I understand it, written by Upton Sinclair, who was a vegetarian for a period of time, and he wrote about the treatment of the cattle at the Union Stockyards in Chicago, which is just a horrible story. Probably much worse than even our nightmares of factory farms today. And the public got very involved. They got behind that and were supportive, as far as I can tell, of having a pure food and drug law passed. And that led to the creation of the FDA in time. So it seemed very important to begin documenting that time, because we had a new kind of medicine. We had germ theory. We had a new science called epidemiology. We had new laws coming into place for public health establishments, public health officers, public health policy, and most of this was based on the work that was being done in New York City. New York City politics, the research establishment, and the Rockefeller were setting the pattern for the federal government to design their laws and to start adopting these measures to treat public health and make this a federal issue. So from our point of view, we can look back and see that we've been subject to this kind of experimentation for generations. And I think it's important to look at the changes in our whole civil way of dealing with goods and dealing with services. We become very dependent on processed foods, you know, very dependent on our gadgets that, you know, put toxic materials into everybody's home. Just accounting for all of these factors. And then when you bring it up through time and you add things like the widespread use of pesticides and then nuclear testing and fallout and then mandated vaccines, you know, the possibility that that's coming. And look at the polio vaccine in 1955. At the time, they called it the largest experiment in medical history. And the man who went further than possibly anyone in proving that pesticides were the cause of polio, a doctor named Ralph Scobie, made that statement. And he said that it was the first time that he knew of in history that a theory about a disease caused a law to occur, you know, caused a whole establishment to rally behind it, you know, and offer treatment based on a theory. So they've still, you know, I mean, as far as I know, never adequately proved polio. And looking back in the records, you see that when there were outbreaks and there were victims, that there was no discernible virus that they were ever able to detect. Now today, we're in a different boat. We have new kinds of tests. They don't just test for antibodies anymore. They test for the DNA. And they use what they call a PCR test. And this is a test that magnifies a very small amount of DNA to give them a reading. So that if they're looking for this novel flu that they say is going around, a very small amount of DNA will give you a positive read on this test. Now, something I've been looking at more is, well, how would we get things like avian and swine genes in our bodies? And in the 40s and the 50s, and possibly even earlier than that, a lot of medical materials were made from animal serum and animal products. And even some of the flu research that I was reading about, they were inducing very serious infections in people to try and determine how much of their body reserve went into fighting off these infections. And they learned that, you know, the body will start consuming its protein stores in order to fight an infection. And in order to treat these people through this experiment, they were giving them IVs of protein infusions. And these were made from pork. This was swine serum that they were using as a protein boost in IV serum to treat people for infection. So this must have been a fairly common procedure that a lot of people have had this induced into their bodies. And I'm sure there are many more ways. And we also know even from vaccines that this is another way to put what they call xenobiotics, you know, just foreign DNA, foreign material, into your bloodstream. So I'm sure that we've been swapping genes with other species quite some time, you know. And medical treatment is a high cost for that kind of mixing.
And there's really no way to back out of that, right?
You mean back out of having a pandemic?
Right.
Well, I don't think we're really having the pandemic they're saying we're having. I believe this is being generated in the news. Now, all the early reports that I read, and I followed them pretty closely throughout the end of April and May and into June, when they gave information about someone's medical condition, in every case that I read where something was said, the people who died had some kind of medical problem, and they were under medical treatment already for a prior condition of some sort. So they had either a chronic ailment, or they were, you know, they didn't name people's medications, for example. They didn't necessarily give specifics about the illnesses that they had, but they would just add a little line in, you know, to the story and say, that this person had an underlying medical condition.
So if that person died, they could literally be put under the death caused from either or. I mean, or they could just up the numbers on either side of that.
They're basically doing what they want with that information.
Uh huh.
I don't really know. I don't know if all those deaths were actually logged in as counting as swine flu deaths, or I should just say H1N1 deaths, or if, you know, they were left off those numbers. So I really can't say. I just know that it's not very specific.
Right.
And what we're looking at as far as the death toll, we would be under what would be considered normal flu. And when you look in the Army records and the flu surveillance that they began in 1940, we've had flu surveillance ever since. The worst number of cases that I saw in terms of a population ratio was during the middle of World War II. In 1943, they had a record number of flu go all around the world. We have flu go all around the world every year. So every year there is a flu pandemic.
But the one we hear about is the swine flu when back in, you know, World War I is one of the main primary ones, although there were some in the 50s and whatever that were notable. But you're saying that they happen, and it was just a matter of what did it suit them to discuss it and alert the public.
Right. We just suddenly, you know, this has just become a big item on everybody's radar, whereas usually, you know, it's ignored, I think. They don't announce flu deaths in the newspaper normally. So the fact that they're doing it now is to generate this idea that, you know, we're watching this pandemic unfold.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Katie, please.
Well, my understanding is basically the reason that we have swine flu or the pandemic flu is because of how Asia basically treats their pigs and their chickens. If we really wanted to stop this, wouldn't they actually just say, you know, you have to up your standards in regard to your interaction with pigs and chickens, or you don't get to travel around the world? Would that cause it to be limited in most areas?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that, you know, what they're really talking about is a threat. I don't think this is an awful contagious thing that just, you know, it's got everybody under threat. I just disagree with the premise. You know, we had very serious bird flu in this country. In a couple of years that happened after Three Mile Island in that area of Pennsylvania, we had severe bird flu breaking out. Now, I looked at that as a radiation contamination event, that this was a fallout problem from Three Mile Island, and that it was in the environment, it was in the ground, and it was growing up with the grass. and you know, it was causing a problem in their environment there. And in 1984, it was such a serious problem because it wasn't getting better that they had to have Senate hearings about it. So, you know, this is one of my sources to look at. I go look at Senate hearings and see what they were dealing with. And bird flu was very serious. Now, bird flu, it's around. It's always been around. Swine flu was called hog cholera before they called it swine flu. It got the name swine flu in 1918, apparently, when a man named John Cone, who was a veterinarian for the Animal Bureau of Industry, suggested it. He suggested it to the Rockefeller staff. And so it seeded this idea that Spanish flu was a swine flu. But that's never been proven, as far as I'm concerned. I can't find any evidence of that. So there's just so many layers of the story. You know, to me, it's go back to Spanish flu. That's where I've gone. I've gone back to look at that to see if it's possible even to retroactively say this was some kind of a swine flu or even a bird flu. And there's no way to say that. There's no proof.
Huh. Well, let me go ahead and do a station ID. You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And my co-host this evening is Katie O'Brien, and our special guest is Jenny Lake. And we're discussing a number of things, but it all revolves around what Jennifer Lake's been studying with from her blog that's at www.jenniferlake.wordpress.com, and it has to do with the etiology of polio and swine flu and all other kinds of things.
Stuff.
Jennifer, if you think that this whole media thing in regard to the swine flu is kind of a ruse, what do you think that they're not wanting us to look at?
Well, I've got my head so buried in this subject, I'm wondering the same thing myself. I really am. You know, we certainly have enough troubles going on. You know, we have a war going on. We've been involved in this war. You know, it started in Afghanistan. When did we invade in Afghanistan? Right in the early 2002, or was it earlier?
I think we've been in Afghanistan since Reagan.
Yeah, I think so. Anyhow, you know, this is to divert, you know, everyone into and put people into a fear mode. That's the only explanation I have, and to turn our attention away from all the troubles that we're having. You know, issues of globalization, issues of economic collapse, issue of perpetual war. We have all these things to deal with. And, you know, I don't know how much of a distraction this might be for people. You know, that much I can't say.
Well, if you've gone back into some of the Rockefeller and that group, didn't they get into breaking down the things that they were going to utilize for the depopulation of the planet, and that the use of all these mechanisms would have been a factor?
You mean medicine in general?
No, mechanisms for depopulation
like use of you know, your pandemics and that sort, or your polluting the air and the water and the food, and having perpetual war, all those mechanisms that you were just mentioning.
Yeah.
Prior.
Well, we can see it now that certainly, you know, Rockefeller was such a huge establishment, you know, they had so many close ties to politics and the running of the government that, you know, every organization that was created, every think tank, you know, every policy bureau, you know, they seem to have had quite an influence in all of that. So, this is what makes it look very conspiratorial. It makes sense to me that it is conspiratorial. I certainly, you know, would support that idea, because I think there's plenty of evidence for it. You know, given that time period, though, you know, 100 years ago plus, you know, just looking at their interests, they were very deep in oil and very deep in mining. And they had a medical establishment. They had an education board. In the 1920s, they expanded their education board, and they used their funding for this to sponsor science research. Now, one of the people who was part of their administrative group, there was a family named Flexner, and I probably mentioned them the last time we talked.
Right.
But Abraham Flexner sat on Rockefeller's education board, and he recently had another biography released where he spoke about the funding that went to the International Education Board, and he said that there was nothing educational about what they were using their fund for. They were directly funding scientists to do special research for them. And the kinds of science that they were funding in particular were eugenics-based biology and physics. Every physicist who participated in the international effort, Niels Bohr, Leo Szilard, Edward Teller, the list goes on and on. And these are men who came over here to the U.S. To build nuclear weapons over here, but every one of them was sponsored by International Education Funds of Rockefeller. So this is how that funding was being applied. So it certainly, you know, looks that way. It looks like Rockefeller and all the extended and connected and interlocked foundations and agencies and things represent the them that we talk about. The them versus us. That's what it looks like.
And this was around 1920?
Well, 1920, right after World War One.
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about the education funding that went out?
Yes.
Yeah, they were pretty well in gear by that time. I think the International Fund was not created until the mid to late 20s. But that was the time. They were on the spot funding the breakthroughs in physics as they were happening. Quantum theory was being elucidated at that time in the mid 20s. I think it was a conference that they had, a Solvay conference, they called them. Solvay was a man, a scientist himself, who sponsored these conferences. And it was a collaborative effort that mainly took place in Europe, and they traveled to Europe to do it. But Einstein was there in 1927, Niels Bohr was there, and I believe even Werner Heisenberg was there. And he headed the German A-bomb project during the war. They were all there in 1927 at this Solvay conference.
Spell that.
Defining quantum physics.
Spell.
And really, setting the ground for all this high energy physics that followed.
How do you spell that conference name?
Solvay is spelled Solvay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And where would that have been located?
The conference?
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure if they were all in the same place, but I think they were in Belgium, in Brussels.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that Solvay himself was a Belgian.
Okay.
And
so it wasn't named after a town, it was named after a person.
After a person.
Okay.
Right. Right. And I think they had their first conference in 1911. And, Einstein is on record for having published his theory of relativity in 1905. And, of course, that's contentious, that there were physicists before him who had already, shown these theories. And, in fact, the earliest reference that I can get for that was in 1875. And that was from a man named Samuel Palver Preston. And he actually wrote out the equivalent of E equals MC squared and published it in a book called Physics of the Ether. So we've had this forecast, you know, since that time period. So we look at the 1870s and the 1880s. This is the time when Eustace Mullen says the Rothschilds were attaining their heights of power and their heights of wealth. And in Europe, Louis Pasteur had his institute founded for him by a Rothschild. And they were really a model for the Rockefeller Institute. So it started over there, really, just like the physics was happening over there. And in this country, at that time, you weren't getting an education unless you went there, unless you went to Europe and went to some of the universities in the capital cities of Europe, in Prague, Berlin, Vienna, Heidelberg, Cambridge, Oxford. Unless you went to those schools, as far as academics was concerned, you didn't have any reputation. So that's really where it was happening. And I also found out even that the very original human flu virus, which is called the WS strain, it stands for Wilson-Smith, was taken from a researcher in a lab in London. So,
and that was the original strain of flu?
Of human flu.
Okay.
Now, they've taken that strain and they've experimentally paced it through the same kinds of processes that that I've been talking about, exposing it to X-rays and attempting to make it infectious in bacteria. And
so are you saying then, for most of those types of lab experiments, radiation would have been a factor all along?
I think so.
Okay.
No, they don't always advertise it, and it's not always easy for me to find. But if I just go deep and stay on track, I come to it. I've come to it in situations where I was surprised by it.
Uh-huh.
So, X-ray history itself is just atrocious. It's really incredible. They started using them on people in 1896 with absolutely no restraint, and they didn't know how to even monitor the dosages that people were getting, and it was not uncommon for people to get a one-hour X-ray.
I took dental assisting in college, and the dentist that taught our class, his thumb was totally misshapen from sticking the thumb in the mouth for the X-rays.
Well, do you remember back in the early 50s, they had those X-ray machines in shoe stores where you could go in and look at your feet, the bones in your feet?
I don't remember that. I think I was just still a gleam in the eye for most of that.
I'm really old. And I remember as a kid, I was maybe 5 or 6 years old, but that was a great thing to go into the shoe stores and go look at the bones in your feet on these X-ray machines. It was right there.
Right. How common, you know? I mean,
yeah.
Probably most kids, I mean, this was entertainment beyond just, you know, having any other value.
And they didn't tell us about any of the fears about radiation at that time. It was just open that, you know, they would look at your feet and then match you up with a pair of shoes, which
okay.
I have never put the dots together on that one. But I'm sure most people over the age of 55 have gone in and looked at these machines, looked at their feet.
I missed that one.
You did?
Yes.
Well, you're really fortunate because this is real entertaining for us.
Yeah. So, you know, and they did know, of course, by then how dangerous they were. And by, you know, within a few years, by the year 1900, there were lots and lots of fatalities already on the record. So they knew that this was very dangerous. This has always been kept undercover. And, of course, they still don't talk about it today. They talk about how they have low-dose X-rays.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's interesting about that, in 1972, a man named Abram Petkau, I believe it's pronounced, it's spelled P-E-T-K-A-U, discovered what he called a paradoxical dose response. It's a nonlinear dose response. And what they discovered was that radiation and also some of the chemicals that we get common exposure to, the lower the dosage, actually the more lethal it is in many ways.
And how did he explain that?
Well, it's explained basically that, you know, a number of ways. I'm trying to get a real good handle on an explanation for that, too. But part of it is that when you get a higher exposure, it stimulates the immune system to jump into action and start repairing this damaged cell material. But when you get a low exposure, you get very small scattered kinds of, you know, ongoing damage. It happens slowly in smaller areas of the body, and that you don't get a full-out immune response to this kind of damage going on. You just get a decomposing kind of decay, and, you know, the body just tends to not get rid of it, and then, you know, become overburdened by all the cellular material. And that's a real setup for viral infection, for one thing. And
so it's weakening the immune system. And,
yes.
Yeah.
It's just overloading you with a breakdown process. And they think that they know, actually, the halogens, chlorine and fluorine, bromine and iodine, these are compounds that we normally use very commonly. They're in our foods, they're in products, and of course it's being added to water, and that these are also toxic in the same kind of way, that at low doses they can cause more damage than at high doses.
Now, I've heard it referred to them as more as the enes instead of the halogens.
More as what?
The enes is
the
being...
The enes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, now, I mean, like, you
know... Of course, that helps me remember them, too.
the chloramine and the, you know, even caffeine was thrown in there.
Oh, no.
Well, that's what...
there are five compounds, well, there are five elements, but they say that these things don't exist in a pure state. They're unstable compounds, and they call them halogens. When they're combined with things, they're often referred to as halides. You notice that when you look through the chemical names of things, like, you know, chloro, fluoro, whatever. When they were using the fluorine for extraction of uranium from the apatite ore, that's where they get it. You know, that's a big source of phosphorus. And so uranium is part of that mix in that material. And they were using, what is it exactly? Uranium hexafluoride, I guess is what they call it. And this kind of doubles it, you know, this would be sort of deadly toxic there. You've got, the radioactive uranium compounding with and making a salt with fluorine, and that this is one of the sources of fluoride in the water, and fluorosilicic acid, that's another source of fluoride in the water. They don't put sodium fluoride, the stuff that we think of as being in our toothpaste, is not the same material that's being dumped into water supplies to fluoridate the water. But there's a very good essay on the net. Let me think of the name of it here. I think it's just something like fluoride in the atom bomb or something like that. And it talks about the uranium hexafluoride waste product, how much of that they had, especially being produced up in Hanford, Washington, because that was, you know, where they were making the plutonium, and also in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where they were coming up with the U-235. That's what they were producing there. That's an isotope of the uranium that they could use or for bomb-making purposes, or for nuclear reactor purposes. So much of this stuff, you know, the reason why they say, well, they didn't start fluoriding people until after the war, well, they had all this waste. They had all this fluoride waste from industrial bomb-making, and they had to do something with it. And it's just like taking the tailings from the mine, the radioactive material that is too toxic to legally dispose of, so somehow this ends up just being either part of our environment or it gets put back into the process of production so that it actually ends up in products that we build with or that we use. Would not surprise me to know that the concrete that had been poured at the World Trade Centers contained a great deal of this radioactive waste. And maybe that's one of the reasons why they were getting such high readings of radiation at that site when those buildings were demolished. I don't have any evidence of that. I'm just giving you an opinion.
Well, no, actually, somebody just recently said that they did have those kind of readings, and I'm trying to remember. It's not coming to mind right at the moment where that information came from. I'll have to look into that further.
I think it was mentioned in the documentary 9/11, The Press for Truth.
Well, you know, we can ask the questions like, what kind of isotopes were they testing for? You know, how many did they find? Are they isolating one particular type, or are they giving us the spectrum? You know, how much of that information are we actually getting? Is this being used to, you know, support an argument for nuclear bombs having brought down those buildings? I've heard that, so I don't know. I haven't looked into that. But I do know that, you know, we have a nuclear waste problem, and we've had a nuclear waste problem since the 40s, and that I know from just enough cases where I've heard of dumping, where I've heard of things being recycled, that you know, there's a likelihood that much of this waste has just gone back into use. And it fits. It fits the mindset of the time. John Goffman, who wrote extensively about the damage that's caused by radiation to our bodies, was touring, doing a lot of touring and speaking in the 1970s and 80s, and probably up right until his death. I think he passed away in 2005. But he talked about what it was like to work for the Atomic Energy Commission, and he said that their motto there at the AEC was the solution to pollution is dilution. And I'm sure that they supported having this radioactive waste just spread about and you know, reused as much as was possible for them. They did not have any long-term storage solutions. They have lots of tailings and things just sitting out in the open. You know, they're just amazing issues about pollution. I remember, I think it was in the spring of 2008, there was a rash of tornadoes that came down all in one big set, and they hit a place called Pitcher, Oklahoma. And Pitcher, Oklahoma has been a mining town that's been destroyed by the process of mining. But from what I understand, Pitcher, Oklahoma has mounds of exposed mine tailings all over this town, and they've completely undermined the structure. People's homes were literally falling into sinkholes, and just about everybody that could leave Pitcher has left Pitcher a long time ago. They had a big problem in 2005. I think it was ASARCO that owned the mine at the time, ASARCO, and that was owned by the Guggenheim family, and I believe controlled by them up to that point, and that they were getting no resolution in Pitcher about having the last residents there being paid for their property. So that they could move. The Pitcher is way up in the very northeast corner. And when these tornadoes hit the ground in Pitcher, they must have spread a lot of that stuff far and wide. You know? And I think I just learned about it at the time that these tornadoes struck. And I was really trying to conceive of repollution and what that means. You know, to have storms, have tornadoes, have fires, have anything, redistribute all of this waste that's never been dealt with, that's never been able to be dealt with, because, you know, we're producing stuff that even by our own code, we have no way to deal with it. So, you know, obviously, there are a lot of Pitcher, Oklahomas out there, places that, you know, have turned into dump sites for industry.
I don't know. They've got Rocky Flats where it sounds like they're starting to build and sell homes on it.
Well, look at Cripple Creek, Colorado, where when you drive in, you can just see mounds and mounds of tailings from the mining industry.
Mm. Exposed to the open air. Right?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And have been, you know, for at least 50 or 60 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's, I guess it's up to the people to, you know, have to deal with that. We're certainly, you know, being indicted as being a part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know citizens have, you know, done their very best. People dedicate their lives to trying to deal with these kind of problems, and make very little progress over time. The fact that these mounds are just still sitting out there in the open, you know, that there are super sites which are deemed to be so toxic that they're in a crisis state of needing to be dealt with, nothing happens to them. They get designated a super site, and that means that and legal proceedings begin against the companies who are responsible for the pollution. And they get tied up in court, and who knows how long these go on and on and on. And meanwhile, you know, there it is. It's leaching into the environment. It's causing problems. In some cases, in fact, I was out hiking and sort of stumbled across what was a super site, and I had no idea. And in fact, they're doing the same thing, Katie. They're building new homes near it. But what they had done was they just had filled this place over and seeded new grass. And I don't know if they even bothered to plant trees, but it just looked like a nice pastoral piece of land. The only difference between that and another pastoral piece of land was that this one had barbed wire on top of very, very high cyclone fencing in order to keep you out. That was the difference.
I'm surprised grass would grow at such a site.
Well, I'm sure they imported the soil to grow it on. So, I don't know, grass is pretty hardy stuff, you know. Basically a weed. Weeds grow almost anywhere. You know, weeds grow to help balance soil. So, I mean, there can be a beneficial effect to having plants grow. What you just wouldn't want is you wouldn't want to let, you know, animals stray onto that grass and eat that grass. Not if you knew what was underneath. But I'm sure they must have imported that dirt. You know, that was fill that they took from someplace else, and they just covered over that site. So, you know, where I live, there's a mandate in the landfill where they have to cover the landfill over at the end of every day, in fact. They have to put a green cover on the landfill. So,
and is that like plastic or is that biodegradable?
No, it's actually organic green material that they put over. So they're not keeping the organic material out of the landfill. I'm trying to figure out if there's, you know, any reason other than an aesthetic one to do that, and I can't think of one. And I think that's the reason why they do it. But that causes problems, of course, in a landfill. And
well, it's almost like the ostrich that puts their head in the sand so that they don't see it. They'll just cover it with something green.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let me go back to the polio thing here just a minute. Okay, now, because when you were talking about, you know, we had all the vaccines and that sort of thing, outbreaks back in the 50s, but I'm going back through your timeline here, and I'm looking back at it being, you know, coming out, what, about 1907 or somewhere in there? About 1907, and then 1908, the polio virus is discovered by... So he's attributing the virus. The virus is discovered after this outbreak that took place in 1907.
Right.
And then this is also about the time they started working with, I mean, the Cancer Society starts out around in that period of time. And
mm-hmm.
So there's a whole lot of things coming together at once when you look at this timeline you put down here. And,
right.
And also your eugenics, they passed eugenics laws and sterilization laws back in 1909. I mean,
uh-huh.
all these things may have been seeded way back then, and that these, people have a tendency to forget that, you know, these people, that these things came from, project 50, 100, 200 years in advance, so they'll start the seeds of something long in advance before they expect it to ever, you know, come to fruition. And if this was a period for that to have taken place, I mean, there's all kinds of things that we are seeing still utilized
today in many different ways as being causes and supposed cures of things.
Yeah, they've held this vision out for us for a long time. I think they had a lot of fruition, though, in their time. You know, the fact that there that this is the history that we don't learn, you know, in school, it just pretty much just hides it from view for us, you know, unless we go digging it up. But I wonder, you know, I do wonder once in a while what they had in mind at that time. You know, they certainly, you know, established themselves to dominate science at that time.
And there's one, there's a Dr. Alice Hamilton here that proves toxic cause of disease. What would be the purpose in that? And, I mean, can you elaborate a little bit?
Well, she was just an early worker. She was a doctor of integrity, apparently, who understood that, you know, disease was a toxic condition that had developed, and just set about proving it. I don't know how much you want me to elaborate.
This is something I may have brought up on another program recently, but I'd sat down and read through a poison book 20, 30 years ago or whatever, and the first, which it wasn't my background, but the thing that struck me was just that very thing, that there a lot of diseases had similar reactions that the body did to certain toxins. And it's just kind of flipping it from one to the other, but there, the body, when you have heavy metals or you have certain things in the environment, the body may react very similarly to those as they would if they were being introduced to a bacteria.
Right. Well, there's damage, you know. Obviously, people get poisoned by things, and, you know, there's certainly an effort by the body, by the immune system, to stay alive and deal with the damage. And, you know, depending on the degree, I guess, and depending on the chemistry, that's going to determine in part what kind of reaction you get. And I think that, you know, the gamma viruses that we see have a lot to do with the kinds of poisons that we put into the environment. You know, it makes sense to me, and that the virus are not the problem. That, in fact, as things become more complex here chemically in the world, we're just going to see more of this developing. We're going to see more kinds of virus being identified. There is now probably close to 200 types of polio virus. They've added a new class, or they're about to. I still haven't found out if they did this yet or not. But they had three main types of polio virus. I think they've added a fourth now. I lost count of how many kinds of enteroviruses there are. Those are the viruses from our intestines. But, you know, looking through some of this old research, now one article that I found from the first year that they published Rockefeller's journal, they called it the Journal of Experimental Medicine. And anybody can look this up if they like. It's online. It's called the JEM. From July of 1896, they have a study there that Simon Flexner wrote. It's called a Statistical and Experimental Study of Terminal Infection. Now, what he learned from this is that the gut bacteria travel through lesions in the intestines. And he notes here that he's talking about lesions that are so small that they're imperceptible. They can't find the lesions. And he says the gut bacteria just seem to wander through the intestinal walls into the bloodstream, and they end up detectable in all organs of the body. They go everywhere. And they had noticed this doing autopsies on people who had died of pneumonia, that they actually had discernible gut bacteria in their lungs causing pneumonia. So things that we even think of as respiratory in nature, something that we caught out of the environment from breathing, somebody else sneezing or coughing, is very possibly an illusion. That our own internal damage in our intestines would set these bacteria, these virus-carrying bacteria, into our bloodstreams and into our other organs. They noticed this in all kinds of heart infections, kidney infections, and lung infections. Those three systems in particular, the heart, kidney, and lung. And very interesting. He said that, let's see if I can find it here in a notebook. Get a quote. He says here, the following year, now this is a little follow-up from his 1896 publication, and the following year they were confirming this evidence that the gut bacteria travel out throughout the body and infect other organs and make people sick with what appear to be completely different kind of ailments. But he says there can be no doubt that the Bacillus coli communis at this time possesses pathogenic properties, and that by artificial methods of treatment, it may often be brought from a condition of benignity to one of virulence. So he doesn't elaborate on what kind of methods of artificial treatment he's talking about, but, you know, following their research, what they were doing at the time, of course, was x-rays, and then some kind of a chemical observation they were making, poisoning cells, and watching what would happen, or mutating them intentionally, which they did. So those would be some of the methods of artificial treatment, and that they were able to then have these cultures prove that they had changed their qualities, that they had turned from normal gut bacteria into virulent gut bacteria. So this just helped me tie up some of the story about the problems with pesticides, chemicals in our food, the things that we ingest, and then the problems with radiation. whole body irradiation, the kinds of exposures that we may have had from fallout, kinds of exposures we definitely would be having from x-rays, would go right to certain sensitive tissues, and they had proven from x-ray research that our small intestine and our bone marrow is very radiosensitive. Now, I remember talking to you before about nitrogen compounds, and that I was learning about the nitrogen compounds, and I had learned that nitric oxide, which is a natural product that we make in our bodies to deal with the necessary breaking down of cell material. It's part of the energy system of the cells. But nitric oxide doubles the sensitivity that we have to radiation. So there's another confounding factor in helping to bring about a disease condition chemically and through radiation exposure. So I think it's all here. I think what I'm looking for, the answers to my questions, are in this research. You know, and I'm just coming upon it step by step. because, you know, I've already set part of this down in the articles, writing about polio, writing about the Spanish flu, writing about fallout, and I hope to write more about that. But, you know, bringing this up now and getting current about flu, looking at the bacteriophage research that they were doing, you know, it's part of the story that's going on now with this lawsuit that came out of Austria, these charges of bioterrorism, you know, it's naming President Obama and the WHO, and really what they're leveling charges about is about what they're claiming was an intentional creation of a bioweapon by Baxter International Pharmaceutical. And
how did they tie Obama to that?
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure they could tie the Bushes to it.
If I'm not mistaken.
Well, you know, they're just tying everything up in a bundle, and they're just packaging a story to tell. And it's a story that I see that's just full of inaccuracies. I know it doesn't match a lot of the history that I know, and it certainly doesn't match the story of the Spanish flu as I know it. You know, I disagree completely with this idea that there was such an entity as a Spanish flu virus. And they claim and purport to have evidence of this, but there is no evidence there. There's just a story. And, you know, they'll have to do better for me. I'm very unconvinced. And I feel that this is part of the news. This is part of generating a pandemic story in the news to scare people, to alarm people, to infect the patriots and the patriot broadcast and news media with this disinformation. And I think that's their point.
Well, that I see definite signs of that, playing people off each other whenever way possible that they can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where knowing the mechanisms that they're looking at to bring about the result they want is, to me, one of the more important factors to be looking at. I mean, not that there's not other important things to be looking at. What's
right,
going
you,
on
and
right.
You're talking about biological mechanisms, right?
Biological is going to be in there, but what I'm talking about, the mechanisms to bring about, you know, splitting and dividing us to bring about whatever change they want to bring about,
mm-hmm.
and that be, you know, their world government or whatever. And so.
Well, you know, I'm just listening to the message, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard this one man who's part of this. This supposed lawsuit injunction, or whatever they're calling it. His name is Alexander S. Jones, and he made some statements on an audio that I listened to, telling people to resist with deadly force. So, you know, they're prompting people to take up arms, do whatever. This is meant to sow chaos in society. They're certainly contributing to their, you know, to that effort.
Well, if somebody were, you know, pushing and prodding in every other mechanism, that would be another logical way to do it. And if they're putting out information to rile people up, that would, you know, certainly be a factor to play into it. And yet at the same time, if they're fluoridating water and making people docile and whatever, at the same time they don't react that much, it's kind of confounding watching some of these things take place.
Yeah, well, the people who don't feel so, you know, passive and fluoridated, you know, and still have the ability to take to the streets will be the ones to go out and put themselves on the line and possibly be removed.
Well,
so,
I mean, the history's there for that. I mean,
yeah, sure. You know, this is calling out the able, you know, the ones who will respond to this message. Have those people go out and, you know, be the first ones to get taken out. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what their objective is. But, you know, to me it's just dealing with the story. Is this true as I know it? And it's not. So as much as I'm able, you know, with the research that I've already done, it's already alerted me to the fact that there are a lot of mistakes. You know, that's being generous. There are mistakes.
Okay, now, and I can understand what you're saying here, but there's one other thing that comes to mind is when you stand back and look at all the mistakes, one way or the other, in the end, it still appears that the outcome is very similar, correct? I mean,
the outcome? Are you talking about a forced vaccine?
No, I'm talking about
a revolt.
No, I'm talking about the revolt, the outcome of the decline of the population because of whatever mechanisms they're using.
Well, you know, we're in decline because we've had this happening for so long.
Right.
You know, we're in generational decline. You know, we're just getting loaded up here with chronic ailments. And, you know, we have a number of things to look at. We have vaccines. We have pollution. We have processed foods. We have, you know, the kinds of, you know, products and things that we use on a daily basis and all the stuff that's around us. We have stress. We have noise. We have, you know, our cycles of sleep, work, and eat. And we have a lot of things to consider that, you know, we tend to accept as being normal. And whether or not we want to, you know, continue living this way, given evidence about certain aspects of this way of life contributing to the decline in our general health.
Right, but as creative as humans are, you would think that if their intent was to make us healthy and have a society that was functional with minus war and all the other factors that come into play here and a stable society and all that, you would think that we'd have it and we have just the opposite. So it almost makes one look at, or does make one look at the fact that that must be a desired outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So if that is the desired outcome, then we need a better way. Our own survival instincts should kick in enough so that we're willing to forge ourselves a new perspective.
Right, but see, as you've pointed out here too, that when everybody's working off of different information, it kind of makes it really tough to do it on a group basis unless it's done on an individual basis.
Yeah.
Even uh-huh. those, even it doesn't matter what side of the fence you're on, if you're all on you know, different pages, it makes it that much more challenging.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I mean, for me, it's just been a process of learning to be more discriminating in my life about information. You know, when people say things, what exactly are they saying? You know, and what's the intention behind what's being said? You know, does that fit my picture of, you know, either what I expect, what I idealize, or, you know, does it fit my standard for having factual information? you know, by applying some serious critique and analysis to the whole thing, you know, just kind of change my own criteria for having myself satisfied by facts. And
well, that's the really tough part when you're really trying to look for truth out there. And I was talking to a friend today, and she said they're really, but you'd have to do it on a much more esoteric means of saying, you know, what is truth? Because, I mean, it's definitely subjective. But when mm-hmm. we start culling out all this information and only accepting certain things, it, boy, you really paint yourself in a corner in a sense. And,
yeah.
And so you almost have to just let it fly at you and just hope that your mind, you know, has that ability to filter in the things that create a picture of lucidity with this, the information.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, thanks to the internet, you know, so many of us have libraries at our fingertips, and we're able to go back and question history and have access to things like medical journals online. We can read the reports and see the documentation, and start putting the pieces together. So what I see is that there are a lot of people motivated to do that, to look back and do historical research, look into whatever subject interests them, and hopefully, you know, present it to the rest of us in a responsible way.
And another factor that has been brought out recently to notice is I've been listening to some people talk about how they make a concerted effort when a major event takes place to record it, because they've mm-hmm. found that so often they change the story within minutes, hours, to a total different summation than what information was flying around initially. Not that that information initially was right, but they've definitely found that there are planted stories and planted things that when you have events like certain false flag events that may have been orchestrated, that, you know, if they find if one story doesn't work, then they'll incorporate another one.
Mm-hmm.
And neither one may be true.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means that we just have that much more that we have to sort through to look at to create a picture of what is true, and it isn't an easy process. But to sit there and, I mean, these guys when they did these things, looking at your timeline, they had an agenda back then, and they've always had agendas. So now we've got to go back and look at those agendas as well as the facts and the information that came from it.
Yeah, to an extent. You know, I mean, I think everybody should do that if they're sincere, and at least satisfy themselves that they see evidence of certain things. And, you know, this is a community project. I mean, there's an internet community of people who are doing this, whether they call themselves patriots, whether or not they have, you know, given opportunities like you're giving me tonight to just get up and speak. There are so many people out there who are willing participants in this recovery. And I think this is what we're working on. We're doing this to recover not only our stories and our history, but to recover ourselves, to recover our country, to recover our ideals.
And, you know, and this is, I mean, there has been no other time in history like this, and it is, and I feel exactly the same. And yeah, sometimes there's a lot of paths I've gone down that, you know, I'm going, well, that might not have been the best path, but then sometimes I find that, you know, where I would have gone and tossed it out, I might, you know, find that I have to go back and re-examine it, because, you know, sometimes your first opinion or your second or third opinion may have been, you know, skewed in some fashion. But it, you know, I really do appreciate you coming on the program tonight, and especially so short notice. But your work is definitely, you know, I think every time I think I'm headed in one direction, then there's somebody that throws in a curve, and I'm going, okay, let's go back and start looking at some other things here. And don't assume that, you know, what's getting repeated over and over again is the truth, you know. So
right.
And that's important. And I don't try to throw the personalities in there too much, although you can't help it at some point. So.
Well, yeah, because, you know, our attention is being competed for all the time. And it's the success of marketing. And I realized that, you know. Just to stay on, you know. I'm so grateful that you asked tonight. And that's a wonderful thing. So if we made some progress, and, you know, a few more people want to come, and I'm getting a sense of what people would like to read, and so I'm going to be really talking about the research, and I just started posting on bacteriophage, and I'm going to put up some more information about that.
Now, what is that, what do you have it under here for your bacteriophage? Where is that?
It's just on the blog, and the title of this is called Understanding Virus and the Flu, and it just happens to be one article that's on the blog.
Okay.
And
give your blog again.
Yeah.
Okay, it's the three W's, jenniferlake.wordpress.com.
And it's, I mean, the timeline thing has got, it's just loaded with certain little tidbits in there.
Well, most of the things in the timeline were things that I jotted down in my notes when I was getting ready to write articles. I still have a lot of things to add. So the blog is new. I've only had it for a couple of weeks, and I have a limited amount of time to deal with it. So, but as I go, I'm just, you know, I've got the structure there, and I'm just going to keep throwing stuff up as I go through notes and cross-reference things. And I'm just going to post away.
Well, Jennifer, just keep up the good work. And, you know, I mean, you definitely, you know, dance to a different tune, which is good, because we need people like you, you know, looking at things with a fresh eye. And again, thank you for coming on the program short notice. And, Katie, thank you.
My pleasure.
And Jennifer, thank you for continuing with the truth.
You bet. Thanks, Katie. I'm very glad to be here tonight. Thank you both very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
And this is, thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
And this is KHENLP FM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And this has been Truth Quest with Melody.